The company had come clear across the Pacific. One of their earlier performances had been in a small town outside San Francisco, and they were in the East, determined to make the best impression. And so every imaginable act was on hand. Tightrope walkers, fire-eaters, a pigeon charmer, an American who could somersault over 8 horses, the Nelson family of acrobats, Hector and Fow, the lords of the trapeze, Fraulein Jeanette and her amazing bareback riders, William Gregory, the gymnast king, the well-known sweetheart from earlier years, Miss Selma Troost, with Troost being the Dutch word for consolation, a commodity which many lonely bachelors thousands of miles from home would no doubt readily welcome. There were 100 acts in all, and 20 Arabian horses on which the performers might show their paces. There were dozens of clowns, and on the 22nd of August the Batavia Cricket Club staged a match against the clowns' first 11, all of them wearing their circus costumes. The cricket club won handsomely. John Hultum, known around the world as the Cannonball King, was perhaps the stellar attraction. He was a 38-year-old Dane and had developed the skill of catching a cannonball that had been fired at him from the far side of the circus ring. The first time he tried this, the ball, which weighed 50 pounds and, at the time it struck him, was moving at more than 100 miles an hour, took off 3 of his fingers. But he wasn't discouraged by this setback, nor was he put off when a rival in an Italian circus was sliced in two by a grenade he was attempting to deflect with what up to the moment of his demise was said to be a powerfully muscled chest. Mr. Hultum persisted, and by the time he arrived in Batavia that August, he was the world's acknowledged leader in this rather limited field of endeavour. He liked to challenge men in the audience to catch cannonballs. 161 volunteers in Europe and America had already tried, but they'd failed, and the few who tried in Batavia failed as well, including the promisingly named Mr. Thor, against whose fingertips the ball grazed, doing him no harm, but losing him the wager. John Hultum also liked large men to try and pull him off balance with a rope, but they always failed in that as well. Yet when the Great Dane pitted his resilience against 4 horses harnessed to a rope, they pulled in so confusing and angry a way that he fell over and was pulled around the ring in an undignified pother, showing himself not to be quite as invincible as he liked his audiences to suppose. For every single night throughout the first 4 weeks of August, Anna Wilson's Great World Circus staged a performance, 2 on Saturdays, and, such were the limitations on social life for the Batavia's Dutch lower ranks and for those members of the Javanese Society, as were permitted to attend, that the newspapers reported each and every performance in full detail and with a tone of breathless excitement as if such amazements had never been witnessed before. The results of the steeplechases were published, the names of all those who challenged John Hultum, and the outcome, the number of runs scored and wickets taken in the cricket matches with the clowns, and, of course, the outbreaks of bad behaviour and curious mishaps that seemed to attend this circus in just this particular month of 1883, like rarely before. The bad behaviour broke out within the first week. Without the guiding influence of the circus owner, John Wilson, he was overseas recruiting more performers, the competing rivalries of the various artistes apparently spilled out into violence. The circus members all stayed at the Hotel des Indes, said to be the grandest hotel in the entire Dutch Empire, and the fighting first broke out in the bar. They were drinking champagne, the newspapers said, and began to argue volubly over who was the funnier clown or the most adroit performer on the trapeze when one of them, scandalised by a wounding remark, hurled a full glass at the other. From then on, a full-scale Donnybrook broke out with wine, beer, food and fists being thrown in wild abandon. Mrs. Wilson was hit in the face. One of the performers had his cheek badly bitten. The athletes battled the gymnasts, the horsemen with the jugglers. And in the end, the police had to be called. It was a sorry affair, but all Batavians loved every minute of it. The fighting in the Hotel des Indes coincided with a sudden quickening of the eruptive mood across on Krakatoa. After Captain Ferzenar's visit to the island, when he had recorded the 3 huge craters, the 14 new steam vents and the vast clouds of boiling dust, ships passing along the Sunda Strait reported new and dangerous-looking activity. One master reported a vast eruptive column on the 22nd. Another spoke of shakes and heavy blows on the 25th. There were falls of ash and a milk-white sea and a dull explosion. Most ominously worrying of all, in Sumatra on the 26th, the last Sunday in August, a villager noticed hot ashes coming up through the crevices in the floor of his hut. Whatever was happening deep below the ground was clearly beginning to overwhelm the capacity of the surface to keep it under control. Something, somewhere, had to give. It is said that animals are presciently aware of impending seismic doom. Catfish jump out of the water. Bees mysteriously evacuate their hives. Hens stop laying for no apparent cause. Mice appear dazed and can be caught by hand. Deep-sea fish are found at the ocean's surface. Hibernating snakes suddenly appear on the surface, frozen to death if they do so in a harsh winter. Dogs begin to howl for no obvious reason. A retired United States Geological Survey scientist collected lost pet advertisements in American newspapers and claimed to find a correlation such that within 2 weeks of any rise in the number of missing animals, there was an earthquake nearby. There's no firm scientific evidence that there is any connection, nor is there a true basis for a new pseudoscience called ethogeological prediction, which seeks to forecast earthquakes by observing carefully calibrated animal activity. Yet not a few geologists do feel it is at least reasonable to suppose that the infinitesimal subterranean shiftings and strainings that precede massive eruptions or earthquakes could be sensed by animals long before being experienced by man or his machines. But no one has yet measured the link, if indeed there is one. But in Batavia, in that August of 1883, there was one animal that, for some unexplained reason, did begin to behave in a most unusual fashion. It was a very small circus elephant, said by his keeper, a Miss Nanette Lockhart, to be the smallest trained pachyderm in world history. He'd been caught in Java, and she had trained him in a matter of weeks. The entire company adored him, and the Batavian public, especially the children who got in for half price with their servants admitted free, were captivated by the sight of this miniature monster juggling balls with his 3-foot trunk or stepping gaily from tub to tub as it negotiated a little obstacle course. But halfway through his stay, both the elephant and his keeper began to behave most eccentrically. Miss Lockhart began to believe that the other artistes in the troupe, their dander up after they had started fighting with one another, might for some reason turn on the elephant and try to harm him. Perhaps, she thought, they might try to break into his pen and give him poison. Despite there being no evidence, she decided to take evasive action. And so, midway through August, when the ash falls and thunderings and pillars of flame were just beginning to be noticed once again in Batavia, Miss Lockhart moved her little elephant into her room in the Hotel des Indes. He was, after all, her only worldly possession. She may have surmised that the hotel owner, a stern Frenchman named Louis Cressonnier, might take a rather dim view of an elephant in the hotel room, though no sign specifically forbade it. So she settled the animal down, said her good nights, locked the door behind her, and left for an evening of dining with friends. The elephant, denied the company of his mistress, clearly unaccustomed to the luxury and comfort on offer in the East's premier hotel, and perhaps, just perhaps, sensitive to what was going on in the earth beneath his feet, promptly went berserk. He trampled through and across all the furniture in Miss Lockhart's room, smashing it to smithereens. He trumpeted, he roared, he stamped his not-yet-enormous feet so aggressively that other guests thought the entire hotel was about to fall down. And in the end, the Batavia Constabulary were called. They found Miss Lockhart. They demanded she persuade her 2-ton charge to leave the room without further ado. And Monsieur Cressonnier further demanded that the entire troop, and such animals that others among them might have sequestered in their chambers, leave the hotel forthwith and find other accommodations. This they did, and no one thought any more about it. Except that then, shortly afterwards, at 10:02 on the morning of Monday, the 27th of August 1883, the mountain that had been grumbling and groaning for the previous 99 days finally exploded itself into utter and complete oblivion. For 60 million years, the two tectonic plates that converge on Java had been grinding slowly and steadily towards each other, 4 inches every year. Now, on the very morning after the Great World Circus had given its best performance yet, with the artists now all newly accommodated and the little errant elephant by all accounts behaving obediently and impeccably once again, the event that would be consequent upon all those years of subterranean shiftings and slidings was at last about to occur. Chapter 8. The Paroxysm, the Flood, and the Crack of Doom. Part 1. The Event. The death throes of Krakatoa lasted for exactly 20 hours and 56 minutes, culminating in the gigantic explosion which all observers now agree happened at 2 minutes past 10 on the Monday morning, the 27th of August, 1883. The observers, as is often the way of things, agree on precious little else. Thousands of people, far and wide, became suddenly aware of the events in the Sunda Strait, but their accounts of it, like the accounts of any monstrous and traumatizing event, present today a morass of conflict and confusion. The countdown to the final hours of the mountain's existence properly began at 6 minutes past one on the afternoon of the previous day, the Sunday. All across the colony, Dutchmen and Javanese alike were looking innocently forward to the long, lazy stretch of an afternoon of a much-needed day of rest. The first indications that all was not right became apparent to a number of people nearby, more or less simultaneously. They were at the time almost all completing the last moments of their familiar Sunday ritual, pushing their chairs away from the luncheon table, folding their napkins, draining the last dregs of the coffee, standing up and stretching their legs, picking up their cigars, dogs and wives for the Dutch tradition of the afternoon family walk. In Anja, from where most of those very early reports originated, the relaxed mood of the afternoon must have seemed peculiarly suited to the place. Anja was a sedate, pretty little port town, as pleasant a posting for a visiting Dutchman as it might be possible to find. It was situated in a shallow bowl in the volcanic coastal range, a place where the hills dipped steeply down to the sea and formed a cosily protective natural harbour. The beaches were wide and white, the fringing palm trees leaned into the trade winds, there were flowers and banyan trees and a paradise of birds, and everywhere a heavenly scent of spices. The local people lived in kampongs of small thatched cottages, the colonials in neat white stucco houses with red roofs. The finer of these mansions, some like that of the assistant resident, sporting a Dutch flag flying from a staff in the middle of its magnificent lawns, and a private dock with the official's impeccably maintained launch, could be seen to best advantage from out at sea, where they seemed separated from one another by acres of deep green jungle. There was usually a flag signal flying from the pilot station spelling out, "Call here for mail," and the inbound ocean-going ships would indeed invariably call, giving with their presence an air of vibrancy to the town, but since they were stopping for orders and not for stevedores, without any of the slums and squalor of a cargo port. The Europeans in their white tropical suits and topies would leave their houses, servants had their Sundays off, and saunter of an afternoon along broad seafront avenues under groves of tamarind trees. There would be crowds of local Javanese, children running everywhere, pie dogs sleeping under upturned boxes, chickens, pigs, goats, creaking bullock carts, insistent pavement salesmen, all of the carefree magic of an eastern street, in other words, out for entertainment and fun on what seemed likely to be an easy, lazy summer Sunday. If relations between colonisers and colonised in the East Indies were less than perfect, and they were indeed much less than perfect, for the Dutch were not very kindly in the ways they wielded their imperial powers, and they are consequently remembered with much less affection today than are most of those other Europeans who ruled far-flung territories around the globe, then on a Sunday, and by all accounts on this particular Sunday, any feelings of antipathy were soothed and muted by the holiday mood. People smiled at one another. Dutchmen muttered cordial greetings to Javan. Everyone sauntered contentedly along in the broad heat of the early afternoon. And then, without warning, and from out to sea in the west, a sudden sound. The first two accounts to be written of it were to be of a kind that was to be repeated in essence many dozens of times that day. "We plainly heard," wrote one, "the rumbling of an earthquake in the distance. We didn't take much notice of it at first," wrote a second, "until the reports got very loud." The newly appointed Anja telegraph master, Mr. Schreut, was once again idling on the veranda of the Anja Hotel, which was owned by his new friend and confusingly similarly named Mr. Schreut, the local Lloyd's agent. It was clearly Schreut's preferred place to spend his Sunday mornings. He was a young man, and he cut rather a lonely figure. His wife and children were still in Batavia, and after weeks of looking, he had only now found them a suitable house in Anya, and was at long last now looking forward to a family reunion. But until then, as for the past few months, his holiday Sundays were spent on the veranda, puffing on a cheroot, gazing out at the view. 3 months earlier, he had been there too, trying, under Scheut's tutelage, to decipher the flag message that was flying from the yards of the German warship Elizabeth, then sailing down the strait, a message which almost certainly told of the first eruption. He did nothing about it then. He was new to the area, he wasn't on duty, and in any case the local Lloyd's agent had the matter well in hand, was well able to read the Elizabeth's flags, and was already sending historic dispatch about what the telegraph operators would misread as Krakatan, spewing out its great clouds of smoke and ash. But on this later occasion, Mr. Schreut was both on duty and much more observant than before. He remembered later seeing a fully rigged bark heading north, a billow of white sails gliding along the blue mirror of the sea. Then he spied the much less pretty steamer, the Governor-General Loudon, the locally familiar government-chartered vessel that had taken the 86 tourists to Krakatoa back in May, heading into Anya port. On this occasion, the Loudon was undertaking much more mundane and customary tasks, first picking up 100 coolies who had been hired to help build a local lighthouse, and then ferrying them across the strait, then going on up the eastern Sumatran coast to the troublesome region of Aceh in the north, and there delivering, among others, some 300 miscreants, all members of a chain gang destined to be put to work on a variety of government building sites. It was at the very moment when Schreut was watching the Loudon steaming towards the safety of port that there came the first roar of an explosion. It was an extraordinary sound, he thought, far, far louder than anything he recalled from before. He looked sharply over to his left and saw instantly the unforgettable sight of a tremendous eruption. To judge from the billows of white smoke that were now tumbling up from the mountain, as if thousands of white balloons had been released from the crater, he wrote, it was a far, far larger eruption than anything he had witnessed when he was standing at this exact same spot back in May. Moreover, whatever was happening on the mountain was also having an immediate effect on the sea. It was rising and falling, strongly, irregularly, in bursts of sudden up-and-down movements of the seawater that seemed immediately unnatural and sinister. It wasn't tide or wave or wash. It was some terrific disturbance, and the water was slopping up and down, dangerous and unpredictable. He ran down to the beach, where he had spied his deputy telegraphist watching the eruption, transfixed. He said he, too, was utterly perplexed by the movement of the sea. Perhaps the tide was on the turn, he said. But as he said so, a furious rush of water roared towards them, sending them scurrying back up to the roadway. The two men ran to the small white stone building that was the Anya telegraph office, and as they did so, the enormous cloud from the volcano began to drift down onto them. Within moments, all Anya was enveloped in dust and cloud, and it became strangely dark. Some remember the cloud as black. Others, like Mr. Schreut, are equally certain it was white. One of the pilots waiting for orders at the Anya pilot station, a Mr. De Vries, swore it alternated in colour from white, when presumably it was largely made up of steam, to black, when it was composed largely of eruptive smoke. But no matter. It was so thick and heavy that within moments an artificial night had descended on Anya port, and the two men who groped their way to the cable office then found they had to light lanterns in the middle of the afternoon in order to be able to send their first message. They timed it at 2 p.m. Krakatoa, they tapped out in urgent Morse to their head office in Batavia, was beginning a major eruption. It was vomiting fire and smoke. It was so dark in town that it was no longer possible to see one's hand before the eyes. What were the instructions? Batavia replied with equal urgency. Yes, they had already become aware that something was taking place. The Governor-General himself, his Sabbath ease disturbed, had been inquiring. People were milling about in the streets, worried. Chinese traders in particular seemed to have a peculiar sense of unease. The cable office reported hearing wailing. So it was important for Anya to keep its telegraph station open, and the information coming in, the operator tapped out. For the next 6 hours, the operators did just that, giving the Dutch officials in Weltevreden, the name well contended must have prompted on this occasion a sardonic smile or two, a moment-by-moment chronicle in the staccato language of the telegraph of the unfolding events. Detonations increasing in loudness, hails of pumice, rain of coarse ash, first flooding, vessels breaking loose in harbour, unusual darkness, gathering gloom. The Anyer harbourmaster, who was by now aware that the gathering crisis was frightening many of his friends and colleagues, "the day of judgment has come," was a common belief, tried to collect as many of the local expatriates together as he could to reassure them. How he imagined he might accomplish this is left unsaid, but he did manage to assemble a fair number of the colonial establishment. The assistant resident, the public works supervisor, the lighthouse keeper, the registrar, the town clerk, a local doctor and a prominent local widow, and tried to tell them that what they were witnessing would soon blow over, that it was in his considered and experienced view nothing to worry about. He could hardly have been more wrong. At 2:45 p.m. the Loudoun, all passengers now aboard, set off for the 40-mile journey to the port of Telok Betong at the head of Lampong Bay across in Sumatra. Her master, Captain Lindemann, steamed well to the east of the exploding island, trying as best he could to avoid the showers of rock and ash cascading down from the plumes of smoke. One British ship in the vicinity, the Medea, estimated that by mid-afternoon the column had risen to a height of 17 miles, more than three times the height of Mount Everest. The captain said there were electrical displays in the cloud, and explosions every few minutes were shaking his ship, even though he was at the time at anchor off Batavia, more than 80 miles to the east. In the centre of the capital, meanwhile, people were becoming very rapidly aware that matters were getting out of hand. Two seasoned observers of Krakatoa's earlier throat clearings, Dr. J.P. van der Stock down at the observatory in Batavia, and the mining engineer, Dr. Rogier Verbeek, up in the hills above town, had already telegraphed one another to find out what was going on. Van der Stock, the man whose wife had lost her Delft dinner plate in the May eruption, and who himself had noted with great precision the time of the very beginning of the earlier events, once again swung into official observatory mode, even though once again this was a Sunday. He checked his watch at the very moment he heard the first loud rumblings, dashed from his house to the observatory buildings, and wrote the time down in the official log, 1:06 p.m. That time remains today, etched in official records, as the one known certain commencement of Krakatoa's final phase. Confirmation of these figures then came from a totally unexpected source, the city's gas works to the south of Batavia Old Town, and which proved quite uncannily to be of the greatest use to scientists who later studied the eruption. They did so because, quite simply, of the way the gas works had been built. The most visible parts of any plant that produces gas from coke are the tall, drum-shaped metal containers for the flammable gas, containers that are in essence telescopic, which float on enormous ponds of water or mercury, and which grow taller or shorter, higher or lower, depending on the amount of gas pumped from the works to be stored inside them. Today's gasometers tend to stand tall against a city skyline in the morning. They fall gradually over the day as the gas inside them is consumed, and then are replenished as more gas is manufactured overnight. In those cities like Batavia in the 1880s, which had gas street lamps, the profile of variations in pressure, and thus the times of the varying heights of these gas containers, would necessarily be rather different. They would stand tall in the early evening and fall away during the dark, during the gas-illumined hours. What superintendents of gasworks have long known is that these storage containers, commonly but in fact wrongly called gasometers, also act as gigantic barometers, and the pressure inside them and in the lines leading from them go up and down by infinitesimal amounts according to the rise and fall of atmospheric pressure outside them. Normally one would never notice these small amounts of movement, since they'd be superimposed on the much larger movements resulting from the consumption of gas. But an eagle-eyed superintendent, who would be in charge of arranging the pressure in the gas lines according to demand, could notice. And moreover, a paper register of the gasometer pressure is always produced, and was, for most of the time in Batavia, that would show all the movements with great precision. The pressure records are being taken constantly, but they can only in fact record the minute fluctuations in the atmospheric pressure, and hence also the fluctuations caused by an event like Krakatoa, when the base pressure is low enough for the recording meter to be affected by them. The gasworks superintendent would increase this pressure each evening when the streetlights were illuminated. He would keep it high until the middle of the evening, and he would then lower it in hourly stages until dawn. So the best recordings of changes in the atmospheric pressure would be made during daylight hours, when the pressure in the gas lines was kept low because of the low demand. Which is exactly what happened, after a hiccup. For when the very first explosions occurred at lunchtime on Sunday, there is no record, mysteriously. But then whatever problem existed vanished, and the recording trace begins properly at 3:34 p.m. Batavia time, which, since this was still some while before the formal international establishment of time zones, was a little more than 5 minutes ahead of Krakatoa time. From that moment on until dusk, and then throughout all of Monday morning after dawn, the Batavia Gasworks pressure gauge provides an uncannily accurate minute-by-minute record of all of the massive air pressure waves that radiated out from the volcano each and every time it erupted. The paroxysmal eruption itself at 10:02 on Monday morning blew it right off the scale. It caused a pressure spike of more than 2.5 inches of mercury, unheard of in any other circumstances. By 5 o'clock on Sunday evening, when in normal circumstances ordinary civil twilight would be only an hour away, but when in fact it was nearly totally dark up and down the entire West Java coast, and was becoming similarly so in the capital, enormous chunks of pumice began to rain down from the sky. There were 3 European ships inside the narrowest part of the Sunda Strait at the time, the Loudon with Captain Lindemann, which failed because of the bucking sea to reach Telok Betong and so anchored well out in Lampok Bay instead, the Danish salt-carrying bark Marie, which also rode out the enormous and ever-growing waves in the same Sumatran Bay, and the cargo-carrying bark Charles Ball, reaching the end of her long voyage from Belfast to Hong Kong. All 3 vessels were deluged with pumice, dangerous, heavy, sharp, fast-moving masses of rock, the larger pieces still warm to the touch. The captain of the Charles Ball, W.J. Watson, found himself in a more perilous situation yet, somehow embayed, horribly pinioned in the sudden dark rain of rocks, and compelled to beat around purposelessly, navigationally blinded. He was for a long while during the Sunday night just 10 miles away from Krakatoa, closer to it than anyone else who survived. It enabled him to leave a record which was vivid in the extreme, except that chronologically, since it is thought that in the confusion he forgot to set his bridge chronometer to Batavia time, it was different by a single hour from everyone else's. We first encounter Captain Watson when he was beating northwards, with Java Head and First Point, Welcome Bay and Pepper Bay to his starboard, the great mountains of Sumatra to port, and the islands in the narrows of the Sunda Strait directly ahead. Then suddenly, at what he incorrectly records as 2:30 p.m., it was in fact only 1:30 p.m., he writes, "We noticed some agitation about the point of Krakatoa, clouds or something being propelled from the northeast point with great velocity. At 3:30 we heard above us and about the island a strange sound as of a mighty crackling fire or the discharge of heavy artillery at 1 or 2 seconds interval. At 5 the roaring noise continued and was increasing. Wind moderate from the south-southwest," notes Captain Watson here, his mariner's routines never quite deserting him. "Darkness spread over the sky, and a hail of pumice stone fell on us, of which many pieces were of considerable size and quite warm. We were obliged to cover up the skylights to save the glass, while our feet and our heads had to be protected with boots and sou'westers. We sailed on our course until at 7 p.m. we got what we thought was a sight of Fourth Point light, then brought the ship to the wind southwest as we could not see any distance and knew not what might be in the strait. The night was a fearful one, the blinding fall of sand and stones, the intense blackness above and around us, broken only by the incessant glare of varied kinds of lightning, and the continued explosive roars of Krakatoa made our situation a truly awful one. At 11 p.m. the island became visible. Chains of fire appeared to ascend and descend between it and the sky, while on the southwest end there seemed to be a continued roll of balls of white fire. The wind, though strong, was hot and choking, sulphurous, with a smell as of burning cinders, some of the pieces falling on us being like iron cinders. The lead came up from the bottom at 30 fathoms, quite warm. From midnight to 4 a.m. of the 27th, the same impenetrable darkness continued, while the roaring of Krakatoa less continuous but more explosive in sound. the sky one second intensely black, the next a blaze of light. The masthead and yardarms were studded with corpuscents, and a peculiar pink flame came from fleecy clouds which seemed to touch the masthead and the yardarms. At 6 a.m., being able to make out the Java shore, set sail and passed the Fourth Point Lighthouse. At 8 a.m., hoisted our signal letter, but got no answer. At 8:30, passed Anya with our names still hoisted and close enough in to make out the houses, but could see no movement of any kind. In fact, through the whole strait we did not see a single moving thing of any kind on sea or land. At 10:15 a.m. we passed the Button Island, one half to three quarters of a mile off, the sea being like glass all around it, and the weather much finer looking, with no ash or cinders falling, wind light at the southeast. At 11:15 a.m. there was a fearful explosion in the direction of Krakatoa, then over 30 miles distant. We saw a wave rush right onto the Button Island, apparently sweeping entirely over the southern part. By 11:30 we were enclosed in a darkness that might almost be felt, and then commenced a downpour of mud, sand, and I know not what. We set two men on the lookout forward, the mate and the second mate on either quarter, and one man washing the mud from the binnacle glass. We had seen two vessels to the north and northwest of us before the sky closed in, adding not a little to the anxiety of our position. At noon the darkness was so intense that we had to grope our way about the decks, and although speaking to each other on the poop, yet we could not see each other. This horrible state and the downpour of mud and debris continued until 1:30 p.m, the roaring of the volcano and the lightning from the volcano being something fearful. By 2 p.m. we could see some of the yards aloft, and the fall of mud ceased. By 5 p.m. the horizon showed out to the northward and the eastward, and we saw West Island, bearing east by north, just visible. Up to midnight the sky hung dark and heavy, a little sand falling at times, and the roaring of the volcano very distinct, although we were now fully 75 miles from Krakatoa. Such darkness and such a time in general few would conceive, and many, I dare say, would disbelieve. The ship, from truck to waterline, was as if cemented. Spars, sails, blocks and ropes were in a terrible mess, but thank God nobody hurt, nor was the ship damaged. But think of Anya, Merak, and other little villages on the Java coast. Other ships, more distant, experienced even more drama. The Berbice, a German paraffin carrier bound from New York under the command of a Glaswegian, William Logan, found herself in a peculiarly exposed situation. When Logan saw the towering black clouds and lightning flashes ahead of him from his position in the strait's western approaches, he supposed it to be no more than a tropical storm. But as soon as flaming ashes began to fall on deck, a wooden deck that was only inches from his highly flammable cargo, he recognised what was going on, understood the perils of his position, and promptly hove to in the lee of a protective island. He huddled there for the next 2 days, even though the island, by all accounts, afforded him precious little protection. "The lightning and thunder became worse and worse," wrote Logan. "Lightning flashes shot around the ship. Fireballs continually fell on deck and burst into sparks. The man at the rudder received heavy shocks on one arm. The copper sheathing of the rudder became glowing hot from the electric discharges." The electricity in the air proved an ever more serious problem, as Logan later recalled in an interview with an Australian newspaper. "Now and then," he wrote, "when any sailor complained that he had been struck, I did my best to set his mind at ease and endeavoured to talk the idea out of his head until I myself, holding fast to the rigging with one hand and bending my head out of reach of a blinding ash shower which swept past my face, had to let go my hold owing to a severe electric shock in the arm. I was unable to move the limb for several minutes afterwards." Logan's account of the nightmare, his crew gripped with terror, volcanic dust covering the ship at least 8 English thumbs deep, his masts and sails alive with fire and sparks, his barometer falling impossibly low, all the ship's chronometers mysteriously stopped, and the world beyond him concealed in a frequently impenetrable miasma of whirling dust and smoke, does, however, conceal one note of incongruous optimism. As well as his thousands of gallons of paraffin, Captain Logan carried in his cabin a small package wrapped in brown paper and tied with string, and addressed to the curator of the botanical gardens at Beitensorg. Inside were 5 specimen seedlings of a variety of spurge found in the forests of the Amazon and known as Hevea brasiliensis, wild rubber. There had already been numberless plans to harvest rubber commercially from such trees where they grew wild in Brazil, but for a variety of reasons all of the schemes failed. The Berbice was now bringing Amazonian plants to the Indies, from which it was hoped plantation rubber could in due course be grown. The conditions of weather and soil made it likely that it would grow well in the East, the botanists predicted. Dozens of related plants, like tapioca, castor bean and poinsettia, already flourished there. And this particular small story does, in fact, have a happy ending. Despite the rigours of his passage through the strait, Captain Logan, together with his ship, his cargo of paraffin and his infant rubber trees, all survived Krakatoa. And the parent plants of what are now some of the most economically important rubber plantations in the world remain today in the Buitenzorg Botanical Garden, duly and safely delivered. But otherwise, the story of that long Sunday night makes for grisly reading. "Everything became worse," wrote an elderly Dutch pilot at Anja. "The reports were deafening, the natives cowered, panic-stricken. A fiery red glare was visible above the burning mountain." At 6 p.m. the cable linking Anja with Batavia finally broke, the line going dead at the very moment telegraph master Schreut was telling government officials that, yes, the eruption was continuing and indeed intensifying still. Schreut, tapping frantically at his Morse key, found he could not even make contact with the small town of Merak, 7 miles up the coast. With his assistant telegraph operator in tow, he promptly dashed out into the gloom, ran through the old Dutch fort, fully intending to press on up the coast to find and repair the rupture. He found it soon enough, just as he reached the drawbridge at the mouth of the harbour, when he wrote, "There, a fearful sight met my eyes. A schooner and 25 or 30 prahus were being carried up and down between the drawbridge and the ordinary bridge as the water rose and fell, and nothing remained unbroken, including the telegraph wires which had been snapped by the schooner's mast. But we felt no alarm as the water did not overflow its banks. Not entertaining any idea of danger, I sat down to table at about 8:30. Of course, I had made the necessary arrangements for beginning the repair of the broken line the first thing in the morning." It was not to be. Anja would not speak to Batavia again for the duration of this crisis, and Batavia would thus be wholly unaware of the terrible fate that would soon befall the town and would befall all its neighbour villages up and down both the Java coast and across on the far side in Sumatra. The astronomical logs for the 26th of August note that civil twilight in Anja port began that night at 6:22 p.m., half an hour after the sun had set, and when artificial lights were first needed in the streets. Nautical twilight, the time when the horizon ceases to be the sharply delineated line that navigators deem essential for working with the sextant, began at 6:47. Both periods would in normal circumstances endure for 30 minutes. That night there was no such thing. It had been dark in Anja since mid-afternoon, and when the invisible sun did set, the darkness was Stygian indeed, the air a hot, ashy breath, filled with grit and sulphur, disorienting, confusing, and poisonous. By late evening it was the turn of the ocean to take over as the more terrifying manifestation of Krakatoa's gathering power. As the great volcanic engine pumped and stoked more and more explosive energy into the atmosphere, so the sea surrounding the dying mountain became progressively more and more disturbed, and communities that were already huddling, frightened, along the low coastline of the strait began to experience ever greater waves, ever more dangerous seas. The reports from after sunset speak continually of smashed boats and inundations of low-lying land, of ruined houses and of bystanders pulled off their feet into the raging waters. The first and most melancholy accounts were those later given to a number of newspapers in Java by the colonial controller in the South Sumatran town of Ketimbang, William Beyerink, the man who had given the first official news of the impending eruption back in mid-May, when he had telegraphed to the resident of Lampong to say he had felt an outbreak of ominous tremors. Mr. and Mrs. Beyerink and their three children were to endure a week, beginning on that first Sunday afternoon, of the most exquisite agony, much of which they remembered well and provided, by doing so, one of the more reliable chronicles of this very complicated series of events. The Sunday had begun innocently enough, according at least to the terms of the Indies, with the opening of a new village market. There was the ritual slaughter of a baby buffalo, the playing of a gamelan orchestra, perhaps a Wayang Kulit puppet show, the kind of ceremonial that the Bayerinks, who were naturally invited, had seen countless times during their tour. But these were strange times. Krakatoa had begun to rumble again that afternoon, and it somehow cast a shadow over an opening that was not, in consequence, an entirely happy affair. There had been a local outbreak of cholera, too. A housemaid had just died, and Mrs. Bayerink was worried about the health of her children. The children's ayah had seemed agitated for other reasons, too, complaining, among other things, that the birds, which normally flocked around the family house, had lately seemed restless, and she complained that the auguries were not good. And Mrs. Bayerink, warily watching the smoke roiling about the summit of Rakata, was wise enough and prescient enough to accept that one ignored the superstitions of the local people at one's peril. When they returned from the market, Mrs. Bayerink made what at the time seemed a strange request, that the family not go home, but make right away for a tiny village in the hills where they rented a holiday cottage. Her husband, however, wouldn't at first hear of it. The locals, he said, would wreak havoc in Ketimbang town if he did so, and the wilder elements, who had only lately been hired to pick the summer pepper harvest up in the highlands, would soon hear that the Dutch controller had run away, and they'd descend on the town in short order. No, he declared, the family would stay. Mrs. Bayerink went off to her room to sulk, remembering later only the distant tinklings of the gamelan and the rhythm of the great drum, sounding what she thought was a threnody. But then everything changed very suddenly. Her husband sauntered down to the shore to see what effects the new eruption might be having, and came on a scene that quite astonished him. While in the distance the mountain was roaring and boiling from behind an immense pillar of clouds, here enormous waves were breaking on the beach, and the level of the sea was piling up, rising and falling alarmingly, crashing with a weird randomness against anything solid on the shore. There was no wind, no storm, but the surface of the sea had a terrible, writhing, coiling awfulness about it. He could see the Loudon, with its cargo of Anya coolies bound for the pepper fields of Telok Betong, beating up Lampong Bay towards him, then trying desperately to dock. It was being tossed every which way, one moment corkscrewing high on the crest of a huge mass of water, the next being twisted as if by an unseen hand and plunged deep down into a trough. The master then evidently lost his nerve, gave up the struggle, for as Bayerink watched in horror, so the boat, now looking so vulnerable and fragile, suddenly turned away, presumably to try to ride out the fury in mid-channel. The controller stared, now momentarily dumbstruck, as the thrashing waters rose higher and higher up the shore, soon reaching the outbuildings of his own residency. Water began crushing against the stucco, breaking hard against what looked increasingly insubstantial structures. It was this very sight that finally made up his mind for him. His earlier decision had been wrong, he told his servants. Mrs. Bayerink and the children should leave right away. Everyone should flee to their summer cottage up in the hills. For a few moments it seemed unlikely that they would ever make it, for at 8 p.m, as a hail of pumice began to rain down, so the waves began their first real orgy of destruction. They were eventually to reach well over 100 feet in height, and right from the start even the precursors of the mighty waves, even the first tentacle feelers of water, did the most astonishing damage. In an instant here, Bayerink's office suddenly came crashing down along with a clutch of outbuildings. The family and their servants only escaped drowning by shinning up coconut palms and waiting until the waters receded a few moments later. Then they were back on the ground, gathering up valuables, setting the horses and their other animals loose, and then running, as far as they could manage, inland. Their flight was the stuff of the cinema epic. There was a dreadful roaring behind them as they stumbled, half-blind, frightened, soaking wet, through miles of paddy sinking into thick mud while trying desperately to outrun the ever-pursuing monster. At one stage Mrs. Bayerink, by now covered with mud from head to toe, tried to shout, but her throat was horribly sore and she couldn't utter a sound. She felt her neck. It was thick with a collar of leeches. They ran on and on, getting lost, from time to time joining forces with other local people, who themselves were fleeing in great crowds from the thundering, roaring floods behind them. Pieces of pumice hurtled down from the sky, burning fiercely like jagged meteorites. The family and such servants as had run with them reached the hilltop cottage at midnight. They broke out supplies, fed their terrified children, settled them to some kind of fitful sleep. The adults then knelt on the slatted floor and peered through the window towards the raging volcano, which they could see distinctly through the fog of falling rock. Outside the hut lay thousands of local people, all crying and wailing in desperation. Some of the more sober were praying to Allah for some relief from the nightmare. But it was not to end for some hours yet. One of Bayerink's servants arrived just before dawn, saying that the entire residency had been ripped from its foundations by an enormous wave at about 2 a.m., and all the signs suggested that the waters were getting higher and higher, and the entire town of Ketimbang would likely go under. And indeed, when the controller sent scouts downhill at dawn to see the damage, it had been destroyed totally. An enormous series of waves had flooded over every rooftop at about 6 a.m. Nothing was left standing. Up at Telok Betong, where the resident later said water had come within 10 yards of his house, which was perched at the top of a hill 120 feet high, there was a mass of destruction. The harbour master, waiting in vain for the Loudon, said he was swept off his feet 8 times before running for his life. From up on the hills surrounding the town, he watched as the Dutch Navy's well-armed paddle steamer, Berau, strained mightily at her mooring buoy. It looked to him as though not only might the chains give and the vessel founder, along with her crew of 28, but the buoy might free itself too and be hurled about the harbour, destroying all the other ships there, including the barque, the Marie, which was waiting in the roads. Mass destruction seemed to be waiting in the wings. And on the Loudon herself, Captain Lindemann found himself dealing with not only the unimaginable waves, the close presence of land and a host of other ships nearby, a perilous combination that sailors fear most in a storm, denying the vessel vitally needed sea room, but with a terrified crew as well. The locally hired men in particular were petrified by the eruption of St. Elmo's fire in the riggings, and they left their posts in droves to try desperately to beat them out to extinguish what was in fact inextinguishable. The phosphorescence was, they insisted, evidence of ghostly spirits. If any of them found their way below, they would eat their way through the hull and the vessel would sink like a stone. There were an almost endless succession of other very similar reports. There were those from 9 other nearby ships, like the magnificent American barque, the W.H. Bessie, 40 miles north of Krakatoa, the British vessels Sir Robert Sale and the Norham Castle, both of which were hove to off Sumatra, the Norwegian barque Borhild, 80 miles northeast of the volcano, the Welsh cargo vessel the Bay of Naples, underway to Singapore and 120 miles south of Java Head, the Rotterdam Lloyd steamship Batavia, well to the southwest of the entrance to the strait, the steamer Prince Frederick, which had passed Krakatoa on the 25th of August and was by the time of the explosion also well out into the Indian Ocean, the Annerley, southbound and at the time of the eruption standing to the north of the strait, and the British-flagged Medea, whose Captain Thompson had managed to measure with some accuracy the height of the volcanic cloud at the outset of the eruption at 17 miles. There were all manner of curious survivals. One man had fallen asleep at home and awoke to find that the wave had lifted him and his bed to the top of a hill and deposited him there in perfect safety. Another grabbed onto the corpse of a cow and floated to high ground. More bizarre still and barely credible was the man who reportedly found himself being swept inland next to a crocodile. He clambered onto its back and hung on for grim death with his thumbs dug deep into the creature's eye sockets. And there were, in addition, statements and newspaper interviews and private letters home from lighthouse keepers and residents, assistant residents, controllers, agents of Lloyd's, telegraph operators, harbour masters and sharp-eyed civilians of all stripes, as well as an enterprising member of the Catholic clergy named Julian Tennyson Woods, who wrote an exceptionally long letter about the events to the Sydney Morning Herald. From all of this mass of information, a broad summary can be distilled. Krakatoa's final 20 hours and 56 minutes were marked by a number of phases. First, from early afternoon on Sunday until about 7 p.m, there were a series of explosions and eruptions of steadily increasing frequency and vigour. From early evening, the ash falls and the deluge of pumice began. By 8 p.m, the water had become the next medium of transmission of the volcanic energy, and as night fell, so the temper of the sea in the Sunda Strait became one of unbridled ferocity. Then, just before midnight, a series of air waves, fast-moving, low-frequency shocks sent out invisibly and inaudibly by the detonations, began arriving in Batavia. The time ball on the astronomical clock down at Batavia's harbour stopped dead at 18 seconds after 11:32 p.m. because of the ceaseless vibrations. Audible evidence of the explosions began to radiate outwards too, and there was a report from Singapore and Penang that thudding sounds could be heard at about the same time. In Batavia, a large number of people who, kept awake by the explosions and for want of something better to do, were walking around the Königsplein, noticing the gas lanterns suddenly dimmed at about 1:55 a.m. Along the Reichswijk, the main shopping street, several shop windows suddenly and inexplicably shattered at about the same time. Then at about 4 a.m. the nature of the explosions reportedly changed, very slightly, becoming less continuous but more explosive. Someone described the sounds as like a steam engine emitting enormous full-throated whoomps as it gathered speed. At about 4:56 a.m. an enormously powerful air wave was detected at the Batavia gasworks, suggesting, when allowing for the travel time over the 90 miles to the volcano, that something else had just happened deep within Krakatoa's heart. The culminating explosion, though no one on the ground at the time knew it, was soon about to happen. There were four gigantic explosions still to come. The first was noted at 5:30 a.m. The Sumatran town of Ketimbang was then destroyed at 6:15 a.m. and Anyer, her Javan sister port across the strait, according to the very few who survived to tell the tale, was inundated and wrecked very shortly thereafter. The second mighty explosion came at 6:44 a.m., 41 minutes after a dawn which, to those in all of western Java, never arrived that day. Ashes began to fall on Batavia at 7 a.m, although Oscar Hatfield, the American consul in Batavia, reported seeing them falling in the consulate ground 2 hours later. At 8:20 a.m, a third quite terrible explosion was felt in Batavia, and many of the buildings started to make what were described as crackling noises. And then, finally, at 10:02 a.m, came the culminating, terrifying majesty of it all. 2 minutes to go, and according to simultaneous reports, the sky was completely darkened in all of southern Sumatra. The Loudoun was weathering heavy ashfalls in Lampong Bay. The nearby Marie reported 3 heavy seas came after each other, at once a fearful detonation, sky and fire, damp. The Annalee lit all her lights, noted that it was raining pumice stone, that the barometer was rising and falling 1/2 inch a minute. In Batavia, it became eerily dark again, and, most significantly, it started to get cold. From 10 a.m. the temperature began to fall as many as 15 degrees Fahrenheit over the coming 4 noontide hours. Explosions, like a battery of guns, are heard across in Telok Betong. Lightning strikes the lighthouse at Vlaka Hook in southern Sumatra. The lighthouse at Fourth Point, just to the south of Anyer, is hit by a vast wave and destroyed, ripped off at its base, leaving only an amputated stump of jagged masonry. An immense wave then leaves Krakatoa at almost exactly 10 a.m, and then, according to all the instruments that record it, 2 minutes later came the fourth and greatest explosion of them all, a detonation that was heard thousands of miles away, and which is still said to be the most violent explosion ever recorded and experienced by modern man. The cloud of gas and white-hot pumice and fire and smoke is believed to have risen, been hurled more probably, blasted as though from a gigantic cannon, as many as 24 miles into the air. A fearful explosion, a frightful sound. Captain Sampson of the British vessel Norham Castle wrote simply in his official log, "I'm writing this blind in pitch darkness. We are under continual rain of pumice and stone and dust. So violent are the explosions that the eardrums of over half my crew have been shattered. My last thoughts are with my dear wife. I'm convinced that the day of judgment has come." The British consul in Batavia at the time was one Alexander Patrick Cameron, and 5 days later he sat down in his study and wrote out, in the usual impeccable sweeps of fine Victorian copperplate, his summary of what he then knew of the disaster. The document remains today in the Public Record Office in London, largely unread and unconsulted because of a confusion which has led those who have chronicled the Krakatoa events to believe the British consul was in fact a man named Henry George Kennedy. The error is understandable. Mr. Kennedy had in fact been consul in Sumatra and was called in to replace Cameron when the latter asked for leave in November 1883. he wrote a summary of the terrible events for the Royal Society in September 1883. His name is known to what might be called the Krakatoa community today as a result, and most indexes of most books will have a reference or two to him. Alexander Patrick Cameron, on the other hand, remains forgotten and unsung. His report, though, seems today a model of diplomatic felicity, as perfect a summary of the events as could be imagined, considering the awful circumstances of the moment. His report is dated Batavia, 1st of September 1883, and is addressed to Gladstone's Foreign Secretary, the Earl Granville. "My Lord," it begins, "enclosed I have the honour to hand your Lordship a copy of my telegram of yesterday, giving notice of the volcanic disturbances which have lately taken place in the neighbourhood of my consular district. The spot where the subterranean forces have found vent is the island of Krakatoa, lying in longitude 105 degrees 27 minutes east, latitude 6 degrees 7 minutes south, at the southern entrance to the Strait of Sunda. The island was the scene of a volcanic eruption of less importance on the 20th May last, which, although on that occasion an entirely new crater was formed, had no such disastrous results to life and property as have attended the explosions which commenced on the 27th inst." He was actually wrong. It was actually the 26th. "The present outburst commenced on Sunday last, and on that night the inhabitants of nearly the whole of Java and Sumatra were alarmed by loud noises resembling the reports of heavy artillery, which continued throughout the night and at rarer intervals during Monday the 28th inst." The date is also wrong. "It soon became known that these noises were produced by a fresh eruption of Krakatoa, and since Monday intelligence has been slowly reaching Batavia from various quarters, apprising us of the extent of damage done, and proving by the loss of life and property that this is one of the greatest calamities of this century. The residences of Bantam and Batavia were darkened throughout the early hours of last Monday by a thick cloud of grey ashes, the light diminishing gradually as the cloud progressed from west to east, from twilight to almost total darkness at midday, and a continuous shower of ash fell during the forenoon, giving the ground an appearance as if covered by snow. At about 11:30 a.m. at Batavia, and at earlier periods of the day in the more immediate vicinity of Krakatoa, the sea suddenly rose, presumably owing to the subsidence of part of Krakatoa and other islands, or to a submarine upheaval, and a wave of considerable height advanced with great rapidity on the shores of western Java and southern Sumatra, causing greater or less damage according to its distance from the centre of disturbance. A second wave, higher than the previous one, followed the first at an interval of about an hour, with even more serious results. It is now reported that part of Krakatoa Island, the island of Poelo Temposa, and other small islands in the Sunda Strait have disappeared, and that a reef has been formed between Krakatoa and Sibesi Islands, the channel usually taken by steamers. Dwazindenwe, athwart the way, an island at the northern entrance to the strait, is reported split into five pieces, while numerous small islands are said to have been raised which had no existence previously. These reports, however, still require verification, and with a view to ascertaining the extent and nature of the changes caused by the volcanic action, a government survey steamer has been dispatched to the neighbourhood to take a new survey of the strait. The destruction caused by the waves on shore, both to life and property, although known from reports already to be hand to be very widespread, can hardly yet be estimated with any degree of certainty, as owing to the action of the sea and the heavy rain of ashes, telegraph and road communication has been either entirely interrupted or is much delayed. It appears beyond a doubt, however, that the whole of the southeastern coast of Sumatra must have suffered severely from the effects of the sudden influx of the sea, and thousands of natives inhabiting the villages on the coast must have almost certainly perished. The west coast of Java, from Merak to Cheringing, have been laid waste. Anyer, the port where vessels bound for Java and the China Seas call for orders, and a thriving town of several thousand inhabitants, natives, no longer exists, its former site now being a swamp. The lighthouse at Anyer, Java's fourth point, has also been much damaged. Many Europeans, including numerous officials and many thousands of natives, have been drowned. In the district of Cheringing alone on the southeastern coast of Java, it is reported that no less than 10,000 persons have lost their lives. The results to agriculture in West Java are not yet officially known. The fact, however, that owing to the covering of ashes which spreads over the whole country, the cattle are deprived of their ordinary nourishment is in itself a very serious consideration, and measures have already been taken to supply the afflicted districts with food for man and beast. It is to be feared that the natives will be greatly impoverished by the damage done to fruit and palm trees, which form a source of wealth, while coffee and tea gardens and standing crops of all descriptions must have suffered severely. With a view to rendering safe the navigation of the Sunda Strait, the Rear Admiral, Commander-in-Chief of the Netherlands Indian Navy, has stationed one man of war to cruise off the southern and another to cruise off the northern entrance to the strait to warn vessels to proceed with caution. In view of the quantity of shipping, principally British, which daily passes through Sunda Strait, and the important nature of the circumstances above related, I have thought it my duty to dispatch the telegrams mentioned in the accompanying memorandum, and trust my action will meet your Lordship's approval. I have the honour to be, my Lord, your Lordship's most obedient, humble servant, A.P. Cameron, Her Britannic Majesty's Consul, Batavia. The island of Krakatoa, meanwhile, had, in essence, disappeared. 6 cubic miles of rock had been blasted out of existence, had been turned into pumice and ash and uncountable billions of particles of dust. The rumblings and roarings continued for some while, then, on Monday afternoon, became ever fainter. By dawn on Tuesday, they had stopped completely. That last great detonation at 10:02 of that Monday morning had blown the island apart, had sent most of it to kingdom come. Now it was time for those who could, together with those whose duty it was, to venture out to see just what damage the eruption had caused. Part 2. The Effects. It was just before dawn on the Monday, and an elderly Dutch harbour pilot, one of those stationed in Anyer to guide ships to and from the Batavia roads, was walking on the beach. He couldn't sleep. Besides, staying inside was perilous, not least because the intermittent hails of pumice stones, many of them too hot to touch, threatened either to set ablaze the atap thatch with which his house was roofed, or to smash holes in it and wreak who knows what damage inside. Much the better, he thought, to watch the great events from the comparative safety of the shore. There was not much visible through the gloom. The clock said that the sun ought to be ready to rise, but the falling, swirling ash had effectively dimmed the view for more than a few yards in any direction. Krakatoa herself, thundering away angrily to the west, was quite invisible, except that there was a dark orange glare to the ash clouds in the mountain's direction. It was like the view of a very distant furnace glimpsed, only half seen, through the dark clouds of its smoke. But then, all of a sudden, the image shifted. Suddenly, the old pilot, who had spent a lifetime guiding vessels through perilous and unpredictable waters, became aware of something that was just barely visible, something that just shouldn't have been there at all. He related it later to the Reverend Philip Neal, the British chaplain in Batavia, who later in the year set about collecting the stories of eyewitnesses, just what it was. Looking out to sea, he said, I noticed a dark black object through the gloom, travelling towards the shore. At first sight it seemed like a low range of hills rising out of the water, but I knew there was nothing of the kind in that part of the Sunda Strait. A second glance, and a very hurried one at that, convinced me that it was a lofty ridge of water, many feet high. 165 villages were devastated, 36,417 people died, and uncountable thousands were injured in the aftermath of the eruption at Krakatoa, and almost all of them, villages and inhabitants, were victims not of the eruption directly, but of the immense sea waves that were propelled outwards from the volcano by that last night of detonations. It was in this one respect, the production of a number of massive and highly destructive sea waves, that Krakatoa was then and remains today so very unlike almost all of the other of the world's great volcanic disasters. Its scale was phenomenal. The number it killed was unimaginably vast, but it was the way that it killed all those people that still sets Krakatoa apart. For other volcanic eruptions around the world kill people in more direct and predictable ways, and they kill and injure, it should be remembered, a not insignificant number of people, since 1 in 10 of the world's population is currently reckoned to live near volcanoes that are either active or have the potential to become so. So far as volcanoes are concerned, there are a huge number of people, in the Philippines, in Mexico, on Java, in Italy even, who are currently living in harm's way. The types of hazards to which such people are likely to fall prey, or to which their forebears fell victim in the past, are many and manifest. Erupted boulders and lumps of partly congealed lava, generally known by the term tephra, from the Greek word for ash, scream back down from the skies and flatten anything in their path. Perhaps a relatively small number of people, fewer than 1,000, died in this way from the Krakatoa eruption. All of these people were in southern Sumatra, in the path of the prevailing wind. The hot ash that burned them alive had sped westward from Krakatoa on top of a cushion of superheated steam. Most of the other means with which volcanoes kill their victims were not experienced here. In other eruptions, there are lava flows that surround and trap victims and sear them to death. Earthquakes associated with volcanoes destroy buildings, and huge seismically caused cracks in the earth swallow people and the buildings in which they live. The terrifyingly fast-moving clouds of hot lava, ash, pumice, and incandescent volcanic gases, known to the French as nuées ardentes, and to the rest of the world as pyroclastic flows, sweep people up and incinerate them in seconds, as with, for example, almost every one of the 28,000 inhabitants of Saint-Pierre in Martinique, who in May 1902 had been persuaded to stay in town for a supposedly important election, but were burned and suffocated by the sudden pyroclastic flows coursing down from the eruption of Mont Pelee. Yet again, clouds of sulphur dioxide gas, usually released during eruptions, can choke and poison their victims. Clouds of carbon dioxide suffocate them. Clouds of hydrochloric acid gnaw away at their lungs. The torrents of volcanic mud and water slurry that course down the sides of certain volcanoes, and which have the Javanese name lahars, since there are so many such flows running down from the sides of Javanese volcanoes, though not, as it happens, on Krakatoa, carry victims miles away and drown and bury them. Sometimes secondary events can prove fatal. In 1985, a small eruption of a Colombian volcano called Nevada del Ruiz melted a glacier near the summit. The resulting river coursed down a valley that was quite unused to such huge flows, and the mud sea that was eventually created drowned an entire village below, killing 23,000 people. There are still more obscure risks. For example, volcanoes that erupt beneath glaciers, which tend not to have too many people living near them, produce sudden floods of melting ice, which have recently been given the exotic Icelandic name Jökulhlaups, and which can prove fatal also. However, of all the victims whose deaths can be directly attributed to volcanic activity that has occurred during the last 250 years, fully a quarter are now believed to have died, drowned, or smashed to pieces as a result of the gigantic waves that were created as a direct result of the eruptions. The entire Minoan civilization on Crete, for example, was supposedly wiped out in 1648 BC when either volcanic tephra from the eruption of Santorini, or much more probably the tidal waves or tsunamis thrown up by the eruption, destroyed the palaces at Knossos. More than 10,000 people died in 1782 in the waves that were created by an avalanche of volcanic debris that hurtled into the sea from Japan's Mount Unzen. In 1815, a similar number of Javanese died when Tambora exploded, sending pyroclastic flows raging into the ocean with tsunamis radiating out in all directions and inundating the coast. Careful study of the records for the last 2.5 centuries has come up with a total of some 90 tsunamis for which volcanoes alone can be held responsible, and the greatest of these by far was that caused by the 1883 eruption of Krakatoa. About 35,500 men, women and children died as victims of the gigantic waves that accompanied or were caused by the death throes of this island mountain, and they account for more than half of all those in the world who are known ever to have died from waves caused by an erupting volcano. So this should be remembered well. It was neither fire nor gas nor flowing lava that killed most of the victims of Krakatoa, all but the 1,000 of them who were burned in Sumatra by the immolating heat of newly made ash and pumice and scalding gases died by the primary agency of water. During the eruptive days back in late May, the state of the sea was certainly noticed, but was never once reported to be the cause of any undue alarm. The hopper Samarang noticed a swell powerful enough to lift her screw out of the water. The lighthouse keeper saw the surface of the strait turn suddenly white. The rudder of the Bintang, another small hopper of a ship, swung around and hit her own hull with a mighty clang when a freak wave caught her. but that was about all. The eruption in its opening stages was all about ash falls and noise and that 7-mile-high column of coiling smoke. The ocean seemed to prefer not to become involved. But 3 months later, matters were very different. The way that Krakatoa's immense outpouring of thermal energy was converted into mechanical energy, for this conversion is what essentially determines both the immensity and the enormity of any volcanic eruption, was altered. The noise was there on an extraordinary scale. The expulsion of material high into the sky went on, both in gigantic amounts and for a very long time. But most of the mechanical energy went into the enormously difficult task of moving the ocean, movement which, once started and given additional shoves from behind, can become one of the most powerful natural forces imaginable. In August, the state of the sea was something noticed by all. Right from the beginning, when telegraph master Schreut took his lunch and strolled out onto the hotel veranda to see that first column of smoke, it was the strangely erratic motion of the sea that most alarmed him. On the far side of the strait in Kettimbang, Mr. Controller Byrink, too, was astonished by the punishment his town's little dock was having to take from the curiously restless waters. The ships out in the strait, the Loudon, the Marie, the Charles Bowell, all reported on the state of the sea. For them, since waves at sea are not half so dangerous to a ship as are waves close to land, it was not so serious, though, as was the electricity in the air and the rain of flaming rocks from the sky. As darkness fell, so the sea became ever more furious. At 7 p.m. on the Sunday, Byrink sees small boats being tossed about. At the same time, on the Javan side, Schreut finds his telegraph cable has been snapped by the mast of a schooner tossing on the waves. Between 7 p.m. and 9 p.m., several houses close to the seafront in the small town of Chiringing, well to the south of Anya, were reported destroyed and swept away. At about 7:30 p.m., a quarry near Merak, where dozens of Chinese labourers were hewing out stone for the new Batavia docks, was then inundated, and the camp where the workers slept was washed away. They may have been the first casualties of what was to be a long and mortally expensive night. But now there was a lull. Though a village 5 miles out of Anya was reported to be submerged at 10 p.m., by midnight the sea was glass smooth once again, and at 1 a.m. on the Monday morning, Mr. Schreut, still trying feverishly to repair his severed cable, he eventually failed, noticed only small oscillations in the surface of the sea close to where the Anya Canal debouched into it. Then, at 1:30 a.m, one almighty wave is reported to have rushed up the long funnel of Lampong Bay to Telok Betong, where it ripped through and ruined several houses. But although it was clearly highly destructive, and though the time of its occurrence seems to have been accurately noted and has been cross-checked with other witnesses, not least the servants of Controller Byrink, sheltering with his family in their hilltop cottage, this one wave appears to be something of an aberration, far larger than its predecessors, but unrelated to any particular event over at the volcano. It was indicative, however, of what was to come. The greatest and most terrifying volumes of water began moving in concert with Krakatoa's 4 culminating explosive eruptions, the first eruptive paroxysm being timed, as we have seen, at 5:30 a.m. It was as though then something deep within the mountain had begun a series of low-frequency pulsations, the sea moving back and forth in time with each pulse, and the amplitude of these movements becoming greater and greater, the volume, as it were, of the waves becoming stronger and stronger with each sequence of pulses. The 4 major tsunamis that were caused by, or were coincident with, these giant volcanic explosions then hit the shore like planet-sized wrecking balls, the effects all unimaginably, unutterably, and fatally destructive.